From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Vincent Harding. He was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center, and he's the author of A History of the Black Struggle for Freedom in America. Also today, I speak with actor Ray Sharkey. Last season, he played the mobster Sonny Steelgrave in the TV crime series Wise Guy, just one of the streetwise characters Sharkey has become known for. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the debut recording of the American Jazz Orchestra. They perform compositions by Benny Carter, who is also the featured soloist. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the first offering this season from American Playhouse, Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Vincent Harding wants to make sure that Martin Luther King Day does not become an occasion to trivialize King's life and work in the way we sometimes let our holidays make clichés of the great people and events the holidays were created to honor. Harding was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. He knew King from 1961 to 68. Harding was King's neighbor in Atlanta and worked with King in the Civil Rights Movement, leading workshops in nonviolent resistance. Now Harding is a writer and teacher. His books include The Other American Revolution and There is a River, The Black Struggle for Freedom in America. He is the former chair of the Department of History and Sociology at Spelman College and now is a professor at the Iliff School of Theology at the University of Denver. Harding doesn't want us to lose sight of the full scope of King's vision.
There is a temptation, and it's been a temptation ever since the first energies were put into trying to make this into a holiday. There's been a great temptation on the part of many people, for good and bad reasons, to smooth King off, to tame him down, to make him much more acceptable as a kind of a national figure. And I think that that's an understandable but an ill-advised sort of direction. My sense is that we have a choice now as a nation, really, that we can try to cut King down to our size, and we are in a rather narrow phase of our life now, with narrow expectations, with cautiousness as our guide, with an unwillingness to take major risks for new human initiatives. And King represented that lack of caution, represented that willingness to take risks, that willingness to go against the grain. And King, by the end of his life, was a very, very deeply criticized, harassed, surveyed man. He was accused by the government of being a communist dupe. He was accused by black people of deserting the black struggle. He was approved by the keepers of the conventional wisdom as being naive and out of his water. And he was in trouble in many ways because he had determined that what he had to do was to set his face towards particularly the issues of poverty in the society and how they could be addressed with courage and with outright strength, and the issue of this country's militarism and its paranoid anti-communism. So these were some of the kinds of things that Martin had decided he had to take on. These kinds of things are very rarely talked about as we approach the holiday. So I'm concerned that we will try to take the Martin who was ragged and rugged and rough and adventurous and courageous and try to smooth him off and make him into an acceptable national hero.
Do you think we've already started doing that?
To a great degree. When you have Mr. Reagan and Mr. Bush and lots of other misters and misses, you know, now talking as if all that King was concerned about was, quote, prejudice in our society, And now they say, well, you know, we still have some prejudice, but we've gone a long way, and we're very happy that Martin King lived. No one talking about King's fundamental criticism of our foreign policy. No one talking about King's concern about materialism in American life, about the dangers of American capitalism in the way that it refuses to deal with the bottom rung of our society. No one raises those. My sense is that until we take on those rough edges of King and pick up his really large and overwhelming and frightening issues, we're not doing him justice and we're not doing ourselves justice as a nation.
My guest is Vincent Harding, who has written about Martin Luther King, and he's also the author of the book There Is a River. He worked with Martin Luther King for about 10 years and was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Did Martin Luther King have anything to do with your initially going south? You grew up in the North in Harlem. Did he have anything to do with your going south and joining the civil rights movement?
Now, directly, I would not say that King was the most direct inspiration. The thing that I remember most as Rosemary Harding and I, my wife and I, were talking about the South and talking about an invitation that came to us towards the end of 1960 to go South and to participate in the movement, the thing that was most on our mind was that we had been to one of those many meetings that were taking place in the North at that time, in which students and others from the freedom movement had come north, were reporting on what their experiences had been in the South, were singing the freedom songs, were moving people deeply. And my own recollection at this stage, 25 years later or more, is that it was their telling of their story and their singing of their songs and making that situation, wherever they had been, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, doesn't make much difference right now, but they're making that very, very real and alive and making it a kind of first priority for this nation as a whole that began to grip us. King was a kind of figure, a presence, and certainly one had to see him as a sort of inspirational presence.
Civil rights or any kind of social change-oriented action is a lot easier to talk about than to really maintain a commitment to. Did he ever test you in any way to see how deep your commitment went and how much you were willing to sacrifice and how many risks you were willing to take to really see it through?
No, I never had any sense that he was doing that. I think he simply assumed that we would not have left the North and its, quote, relative safety to come South and to offer ourselves in what was essentially a kind of non-paying volunteer kind of capacity for a number of years, unless there were some kind of commitment there. So I think that we hit it off very well from the outset, and I never felt that he felt any need for that kind of testing.
Did you yourself feel tested, though? I mean, were there times when you knew that this was going to be a turning point for you, that it was a potentially dangerous and frightening situation, and that you had the choice of either leaving for safety or of staying at great physical or personal risk?
Well, yeah, there were a number of occasions like that. But as we moved through the South, and we operated all through the South and got to know a lot of the grassroots people, there was a sense in which we were now connected to a living community, as it were, scattered but very real. And so at times when there surely were the temptation to think that this is just getting too much, we were encouraged by these folks who had never left, who could never leave, and who would never leave. And we were also encouraged by the people who had come to have a certain faith and confidence in us. And so I think that, yes, there were times of testing like that, but it was terribly important to have a kind of living nexus, a living community of folks who almost literally held you to your commitment.
What was one of those times, though?
Well, An example would be in the midst of the Albany, Georgia campaign, when one of the most admired women in that community, the wife of the vice president of the Albany movement, who was pregnant at the time, was kicked and beaten by a sheriff when she went out to visit some people in jail. And the community was very angry. There was a tremendous possibility of explosion taking place there out of that justifiable anger. And Martin, at that particular point, was operating out of an injunction and had decided, at least temporarily, to observe the injunction and did not want to lead any kind of action. So he asked me if I would move away from the negotiating role at that point, because nonviolence was so important in the situation, if I would lead a group that would allow members of the community to express their concern by going down to the police station and standing there against the law, praying there against the law, and being ready to take whatever came on. And it was just one of those nights, and it was a nighttime thing, when it looked like half of the county and state troops in the area were there in town in Albany, Georgia. And it was a relatively small group of us, I think maybe 8 or 10 people, who decided that night to go down there and to make that kind of demonstration of protest against what had happened. And I remember, you know, feeling as we drove the car down to where we were going to park and then get out to go to the police station, you know, am I really going to walk into this, and where is this going to lead? But there were a number, especially of college-age young people who were with me. I was in my late 20s at the time, who were so clearly ready to go and who were so clearly expecting me to lead them that I simply had to go trembling. It's the way that we often remember that song that we used to sing, we are not afraid, we are not afraid. Well, we'd be singing, we're not afraid, but our knees would be practically buckling. But what it meant to us was that we will not allow our fears to overcome what we know is necessary and what we know must be done under the circumstances. And so that was one of the circumstances. And I was glad when it was done that it was done, and spent time in jail and felt very, you know, strengthened by that.
During that period in the South, you were in the position of having to introduce people to the concept of nonviolent direct action. It was a pretty new concept, and really it hadn't been practiced in the United States before it was in the civil rights movement. What were some of the ways you'd introduce the idea to people, and what were some of the reactions that you got?
Well, for one thing, we tried to make it very clear that what we were talking about was a way of struggling for truth and justice that required great courage and great strength, and that we did not want people who did not feel they had the courage to stand in the midst of whatever would come.
And I guess you didn't want people to think that you were asking them to be cowards and afraid
to
fight.
Precisely. No, we tried to redefine, and this is the way of classic nonviolent struggle. We tried to redefine what fighting was about. It was not fighting. It was fighting, choosing your own weapons rather than allowing yourself to be sucked into the weaponry of the opponent that you're struggling with. We tried as much as possible, and we didn't have to work very hard on this, because many black people, in their wisdom there in the South, saw what that kind of weapon love and that romance with the gun and that militarism of the South had done to so many white Southerners. That it had warped them and their values and their capacity to really be human. And so we tried to make clear to people that what we were trying to do was develop a way of struggle against that, which would use other approaches, which would challenge that. And one of the critical things that we felt we wanted to do was to find a way of struggle that everybody could participate in. You didn't have to be a big, strong, macho man to do it. You could be an 80-year-old grandmother. You could be a 12-year-old young woman. And you still, operating from the center of your own being, from the strength within you, you could stand up to Sheriff Clark. And you could be ready to go to jail and take whatever came on. So that kind of thing was very, very important. The other thing that we tried to help people to see was that in the Deep South, and of course this is one of the great differences between North and South again, that in the Deep South, so many of the black community, the overwhelming majority, were products of the black church and were deeply shaped by the whole Jesus story. And we could call upon the Jesus story of the one who fought against evil, but fought against evil by opening up his arms and by being absolutely strong, not backing down, but not taking the life of anyone else either, being willing to die rather than to kill for what you believe in. And the Jesus story and the Jesus example, very, very important as far as the black community was concerned. So it was that gamut of things. And, of course, just the very, very, what people call practical element that you try to pick up guns in South Carolina, Alabama, you are inviting precisely what those folks want you to do. And you are therefore offering no creativity to the struggle, and you're offering very little chance to your children as well.
Vincent Harding is my guest. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Vincent Harding, who worked with Martin Luther King for about 10 years and was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Was there any kind of training that you offered before demonstrations so that people would know some idea of how to behave?
Yeah, there was a lot of role playing. I think that we were some of the original role players in terms of the role playing movement in our society. A lot of role-playing of how to deal with people on a verbal level, because one of the things that we were deeply concerned about was that at our best, we should be not simply people who are acted in a certain way, but people who had a certain spirit as well, and who could communicate the spirit, a spirit which essentially said, I am not afraid of you, I am not going to back down to you, but I'm not going to hate you either. And to we were trying to help people to develop that kind of capacity to be strong without being overcome by their justifiable anger and indignation under the situations. So we talked about spirit. We talked about how simply to handle themselves physically in situations where they would be beaten. And we talked constantly about how you act under provocation when people are clearly trying to provoke you in such a way that they have justification for shooting your head off.
What suggestions would you have for that when someone is trying to provoke you so that they have a reason to actually beat you or shoot you?
One of the things that we always were trying to do is make sure that people were operating in as much connection with others as possible, so that folks could encourage one another, so that they could remind one another, don't let them do that to you. Remember what we're here for. So we tried to encourage people, you know, to stand with one another. But of course, there was no guarantee that any of these things would work. I remember one workshop where Fannie Lou Hamer and two of her marvelous sisters were working on this kind of thing, and were leaving the workshop, a voter registration workshop, and going back to Mississippi. The workshop was in South Carolina. And so they found themselves in Winona, Mississippi, on the eastern edge of Mississippi, and decided that they were going to act out what they believed in. And they were taken into jail and beaten unmercifully. But Annelle and Fannie Lou and June really just became even stronger in that situation. And I remember one of the, I wasn't there when they came out of the jail, but I was told that Annelle's face was just terribly swollen up. When she came out from the beating, she could hardly speak. But when she saw her friends after she got out of jail, the first word she spoke was freedom. Now, that for me is an indication of the great strength of the human spirit. And what you do, of course, is that you recognize that as you are developing people and helping people and training people, that that people are going to have to pay great price for freedom. And I think that, to go back to our beginning, that what we would like to do is to have a hero like Martin Luther King Jr. and forget the price that has to be paid still. But those folks kept reminding me that freedom comes only at great cost, and that we have to be prepared to pay the cost.
We have very high personal expectations of our political and social leaders, and you knew King on a personal level as well as on a working level. Was he able to, in personal relationships with friends and family, abide by the principles that he laid out for social change and for the civil rights movement? Because you'd really have the impression of him having to be a saint from the actions that he carried out, and there are very few people, if any, who can really behave that way in their personal lives.
Well, I think, Terry, that in terms of any of our definitions, usual definitions of saint, Martin was not a saint. King, for me, is special in the sense that he is an illustration of what can happen with a person's life in spite of weaknesses. We would like to make people saints so that we will be excused from significant action by our weaknesses. And so we assume that they have none, and that's the reason why they were involved in significant action and choice making. I think Martin takes away that kind of excuse from us. Martin had weaknesses. Martin had failings. Martin moved in situations where he made at times very poor decisions. In spite of that, Martin was able to keep getting up and keep moving in the direction that he had set his face. And I'll just mention a couple of kinds of things. King came out of a long tradition of the Baptist church in the black community. Very hierarchical tradition. On a certain level, very preacher-centered, one leader-centered. Martin always was conscious of that. He was not unconscious of that tradition. And he was conscious of the problems that that tradition carried, as well as the strengths it carried with it. And he had to deal with himself and with other people around the fact that more often than he would have liked and that some others would have liked, that kind of background came to the foreground. And Martin operated out of that individual leader sort of position. Unfortunately, there were a number of people around him who encouraged that. Here is the leader. Here is the one who's got the voice of the Lord. We will have to do whatever he says. You know, no major debate about this, etc., etc. Martin tried, I think, valiantly to overcome some of that, but often fell into that. That was a significant problem. And when you realize that this man came to be a world figure before he was 30 years old, I mean, you realize what a horrible burden that is to put on anybody. But under the circumstances, I thought that he handled himself reasonably well and tried to keep himself human. That was very difficult.
Were you totally shocked by his assassination, or did you thought that something like that was likely to happen in this country, which is so violent?
None of us who were any place nearby what was going on could be surprised. It is possible to be shocked simply because of what it does to your own being to lose a friend and coworker in that kind of way. But I certainly was not surprised in the sense that I didn't think it could happen, because Martin, at least from 1965 on, and in different ways pre-1965, the thought was that some folks from the white racist community would do something like that in some unexpected spot or situation. After King began dealing with Vietnam and the war, etc., and poverty and things of this sort, then more and more people began to see the possibility that there might be something much more organized and much more semi-official about the sites in which King was constantly kept. And so none of us were surprised in that sense, and Martin himself knew and constantly referred to the fact that he was living under the threat of death. He knew that, so he was not surprised. The surprising thing was that he insisted on going on, insisted on living in an open way, insisted on not being overprotected, and felt that he simply had to do what needed to be done, and he was prepared to take the consequences, because he had come finally in his life, by the time 36, 37, 38 years old, where he had dealt with death and recognized that death was a real possibility for him, and that it was therefore very important for him to keep living for what he believed in.
When we started the interview, you expressed your concerns that Martin Luther King Day might be subverted into a holiday where we think of King as being a nice, gentle, non-threatening man who, when in fact he posed a great threat to the way this country was being run.
Yes. The FBI said that he was the most dangerous Negro in America. I mean, there was no question about that.
What would you like to see Martin Luther King Day be?
I'd like us to try to spend as much time as possible looking at his agenda at the end of his life, asking ourselves what were the things that he was most concerned about as his life ended, not at the March on Washington, but as his life ended, and then comparing that agenda with where we are now in the society, and all through the national community, taking a kind of a inventory of where we have gone since that time, forward or backwards, and then also taking a personal inventory as to what we're going to do about where we are now in the light of what his deepest concerns were.
Vincent Harding, I want to thank you very much for spending part of this day with us.
Good. Thank you, friend. Thank you.
Vincent Harding was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Harding now is a professor at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll have a discussion on testing positive for the HIV antibody. A positive result means that you have been exposed to the AIDS virus, but you may or may not get the disease. I'll speak with two men from a support group called Body Positive for people who have tested positive. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with actor Ray Sharkey. He's known for his portrayals of tough, streetwise characters, like Sonny Steelgrave in the TV crime series Wise Guy. Sharkey won a Golden Globe Award for his role in the film The Idolmaker. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album featuring Benny Carter leading the 17-piece American Jazz Orchestra. Carter first led a big band back in the 1920s. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude, starring Glenda Jackson. It's the first production this season from Public Television's American Playhouse. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. The leader of a military uprising in Argentina has surrendered. Lieutenant Colonel Aldo Rico gave up his 3-day revolt after troops loyal to the elected government of President Raul Alfonsín attacked the main rebel stronghold. It was the second rebellion led by Lieutenant Colonel Rico in 9 months. The Nicaraguan government today announced the release of 7 political prisoners arrested on Friday. The release is tied to recent promises by the Sandinista government to meet the terms of the Guatemala peace plan signed last summer. In Washington, the State Department called Nicaragua's latest concessions a ploy to defeat upcoming congressional aid to the Contra rebels. The administration is scheduled to make a formal request for the aid on January 26th. Today's state and local elections were relatively peaceful in the Philippines, despite warnings of an attempted coup by members of the military loyal to former President Ferdinand Marcos. But the campaign has been bloody. As NPR's Alan Berlow reports from Manila, at least 80 people have lost their lives.
Only hours before nationwide campaigning ended, the Philippine elections claimed another victim. Roy Padilla, who was running for governor in a province south of Manila, was shot dead as he addressed a final campaign rally. While the election death toll seems shocking to outside observers, many Filipinos, including Election Commissioner Ramon Felipe, seem to accept the violence as a normal part of doing business.
First, I would like to correct the impression that there has been a lot of killings in this election. According to statistics released by the military, there have been less killings in this election than in all past elections since 1971.
The only difference, Felipe said, is that more candidates have been killed in this year's elections than ever before. One newspaper columnist remarked this morning that these are not elections, but a test of survival. I'm Alan Berlow in Manila.
Ballots are being counted in Haiti to see if any presidential candidates there got a majority of the vote. The military rulers of the Caribbean nation are calling Sunday's balloting a success, but opposition leaders, who were leading an election boycott, say only 10% of the electorate turned out. Preliminary results could come in a few days. Final results aren't expected until next week. Today is the third national holiday set aside to honor the memory of the slain civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He was shot almost 20 years ago. Around the country, commemorations noted both racial progress since his death and continued signs of racism in the U.S. In Atlanta, King's hometown, his widow, Coretta Scott King, participated in a wreath-laying ceremony and an ecumenical service. Mike Cooper reports.
At an ecumenical service at the church where he preached, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was praised and remembered. King's widow, Coretta Scott King, and Reverend Joseph Lowry, head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, told an overflow crowd that King's birthday should be a day of action. Lowry said the holiday should be used to consider important issues.
Dying in the ghettos of despair and deprivation, dying in pits of poverty and sinking sand of oppression and depression. What's going on?
The service ended with the singing of We Shall Overcome in 4 languages. Mike Cooper, Atlanta.
A strong storm, blamed for 7 deaths, cut through Southern California and spread snow across much of the Southwest today. Up to 2 feet of snow fell in the Sierra Nevada mountains of Northern California. In the eastern half of the country, rain and mild temperatures created dense fog and hazardous travel. Fog forced the cancellation of some flights at New Orleans International Airport and long delays at Chicago's O'Hare. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street in light trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 7 points to 1963.86. Advances led decline 6-5 on a volume of 135 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 2 cents. I'm Michael Richards, National Public Radio News, reporting from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Composer and alto saxophonist Benny Carter has been writing music for big bands since the 1920s. In the 40s, he dropped out of the jazz scene to work in the Hollywood studios. In the 70s, he returned to public view as a soloist and as bandleader for singer Maria Muldaur. There's a new album with Carter leading the 17-piece American Jazz Orchestra in performances of his big band compositions. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Benny Carter is one of those very rare major figures from the 1920s still alive and working, an elder statesman who's universally respected and yet has never quite gotten his due. He's known as a pioneering alto saxophonist whose Fleet style paved the way for Charlie Parker. But as an arranger for bandleader Fletcher Henderson in the 20s, Carter was second only to the great Don Redman. Redman and Carter influenced Henderson's writing for swing king Benny Goodman in the 30s. Carter himself wrote for Goodman, and his arrangements were played by other band leaders. Directly and indirectly, he helped develop the language of swing. Back in the late 20s, Benny Carter, like many others, appropriated arranger Don Redman's central tactic, the division of brass and reeds into sparring groups. Carter plays trumpet as well as saxophone, but as a writer, he's never been impartial. His impeccably inventive writing for reeds overshadows anything he has to say on brass. Last February, the American Jazz Orchestra, masterminded by critic Gary Giddens and directed by pianist John Lewis, brought the L.A.-based composer to New York for a concert and a recording of some of his old and new big band charts. Carter himself was featured soloist. The result is Second City Sketches, a double set on the Music Masters label. The American Jazz Orchestra for this project included such prominent players as Jimmy Nepper, Britt Woodman, John Purcell, Lou Tobacken, Ron Carter, and Mel Lewis, with John Lewis and Dick Katz trading off at the piano. Thoroughly rehearsed, this makeshift unit sounds amazingly cohesive. The saxophone section work is precise and buttery. Listen to one of Carter's masterpieces, 1933's Symphony in Riffs, which begins with a deceptive brass fanfare before revealing itself as a showcase for saxes. The American Jazz Orchestra is a repertory group based on the assumption that great scores like Carter's can withstand updated treatment. Musicians may play the notes as written 50 years ago, but their rhythmic thrust is inevitably more modern. Before we hear the AJO's version of Carter's Lonesome Nights, listen to a bit of the 1933 recording with his own big band. It's nice, but a little staid, like a palm chord orchestra. Now try the 1987 version. The orchestra's remake is noticeably more deft. The player's involvement with Carter's music pays off not just for listeners, but for the musicians themselves, who get a chance to learn from a master firsthand. The American Jazz Orchestra's celebration of a living giant is a refreshing change from the norm. Too often, musicians and the press become enchanted by an innovator's work only after the artist dies. The posthumous lionization of Thelonious Monk is a conspicuous example. 80-year-old Benny Carter is more than a living legend. His continued vitality as a saxophonist is amazing, and his playing is one of Central City Sketch's key pleasures. For all he's done and continues to do for American music and the art of the saxophone, Benny Carter should be carried around in a sedan chair for the rest of his life. He is, in a way, the last emperor.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. He reviewed a new album featuring Benny Carter and the American Jazz Orchestra. This is Fresh Air.
This is it, Sonny. What am I looking at? It's federal, it's the RICO Act, if it's state, it's the Malhouse Amendment. You a federal or a Jersey cop? I can't believe you're a cop. That's right, either way, it's a conspiracy, okay?
Mobster Sonny Steelgrave lost his mind when he found out his right-hand man, Vinny, was really an undercover agent for the FBI. It happened last November on Sonny's final episode of the CBS TV crime series Wise Guy. The news was fatal for the character, but it was a great opportunity for actor Ray Sharkey, who got to pull out all the stops in his character's last moments. Wise Guy was something of a comeback for Sharkey. His career had temporarily derailed because of drug problems. Sharkey had starred in the films The Idolmaker, Willie and Phil, and Love and Money. He just finished shooting a new film with Gary Busey. On his last Wise Guy episode, Sharkey's character electrocuted himself as the feds were breaking down the door to arrest him. Sharkey liked the idea of going out in a blaze.
You know, from the very first script I read, it was like a 30s gangster picture from the old Warner Brothers studios. And all those great characters, the way they went out was in a blaze of glory. So now, obviously, that was one way to go, physically, visually. Emotionally, you had to go out. He had to leave Vinny on a note of pain. There had to be high drama, high emotion.
In your last moments, and in your character's last moments, as he knows he's surrounded by the feds and his time is really up, he plays the jukebox and he plays the Rascals recording of Good Lovin' and he sings along with it. It's a really great moment, and I think it's must have been a great opportunity as an actor because people really reveal themselves when they sing along with records.
Oh, yeah. It seemed very apropos to have Sonny say, you know, all I want is love and all I need is love at that time, you know, because it had to do with these two guys and what they were feeling. And I think it worked. I think the best scene in the movie has no dialogue in it. And they're at, he's at the jukebox and Vinny's standing underneath the poster that says John Wayne.
I was feeling so bad. I asked my family doctor just what I had. I said, doctor, Mr. MD, can you tell me what's ailing me? He said, yeah. Randolph Scott was shooting his way through Tombstone while I was working my way through Maria's wire-reinforced underwear. Ooh, I can still feel it. Come on, love. All I need is love. Ooh, give me good loving, Maria. Yeah!
Ah! Gangster and mobster performances are really good performances. Are so much fun to watch, and I'm always trying to figure out why are great performances in gangster roles and mafia roles so terrific. Do you have any ideas? I mean, I really enjoyed watching you in that role.
Well, think about it. They're enjoyable to watch because there's a sense of danger. There's a sense of, obviously, you're a woman. You're watching a man play a performance where the whole theory about going to the movies and creating the illusion is, I want you to think, gee, you know, I could spend some time with this guy. I hope
was it?
What,
Ray,
me.
It wasn't a romantic thing, I'll tell you.
Well, I think it is. That's my feeling about movies and entertainment is it's romantic. And these characters just run through social morality and rules and regulations, and they break them, and they speak what's on their mind. They do things that we all wish we could do.
Yeah, I think it's the energy in the performance. I think it's the energy, and also that a lot of mobsters are also terrific actors, and that's part of their gift. So maybe that's a great opportunity for an actor to play someone who's really aware of his own mannerisms.
Well, I got to tell you, you're probably right, but the bottom line to that is the terrific actors in this generation who are playing mobsters in terrific parts, it's got to come easy to them because they're from New York.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, you're Italian-born from New York, right?
Irish-Italian kid from Red Hook, South Brooklyn.
And you have a pretty strong New York accent still.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you started acting, did you think, and has it in fact affected the kind of roles that you can get? Can you lose the accent if you want to?
Yeah. When I started acting, I was taught that an actor was an actor. You played every part that you can. So obviously we were trained for 4 years in the classics, and you had all these, and at that time I was 17, right out of the streets of Brooklyn, and I was going, yo, this too solid flesh should melt and sever into a dew. You know, I mean, the school I came from was you approached it from in the internal part of the person you were playing, and if you had that thing happening inside you, then you could play the part, the rest you learned. And I'm glad that was the foundation I had as an actor, because now you could play almost anything.
I want to ask you about another role. You starred in the movie The Idolmaker, and you played a songwriter in the late 1950s who desperately wants to have hit records, but the songwriter thinks that he's not handsome and sexy enough to really put his own songs across. So he gets good-looking teenage guys better, you know, who better look the part, and he makes them into rock and roll idols.
When are you going to wise up, eh, Tommy? What do you want to do, play backup sax and juke joints all your life, hustling dimes from the neighborhood kids? You could be somebody. You could be Tommy D.
Tommy D. Who the hell is Tommy D?
I can't be a jerk off, that's right. You want to know something, kid? You got the look. You know the guys in the fan magazines? That's it, Tommy. They got it. I can make it happen for you, if you want it. What's it going to be, pizza or caviar?
Now, could you relate to that hunger to break in, to that hunger that this idol maker has to break into show business?
Those were basically the things that I had felt when I was a kid. I could do that. I used to go to rock and roll concerts and say, gee, I could do that. I wish I could do that. But, you know, I just don't look that way. Maybe you got to have a certain look. And so that part of it was from inside my heart. And the other part was, how would, in terms of the drive and the hunger, how would I approach it? And that's exactly how I do it.
Your role in Wise Guy was something of a comeback for you. You were out of acting for a while. Could you explain what had happened during that hiatus?
Actually, I wasn't. That's very nice of you to put it that way. But I was still acting. Only I was taking like parts that were very obscure because I was hoping people wouldn't see me, and I can just make the money and take the money and party with it. I was having what I thought was a good time. I was just traveling around the country, using drugs and drinking, and I thought I was having a good time.
Was there a period when you were thinking that this wasn't affecting your acting at all?
Definitely. Most definitely. I mean, I thought it was making it better. I didn't do it while I was actually acting. I would do it like afterwards at night. And then that sort of, in the last year of my abuse, it sort of like leaked into, sneaking into the bathroom at the trailer and having the ADs wait for me and telling them that I was taking a large dump. And then it started to get in the way of my work. It was time to get it together.
You know, one of the really nice things I always feel about acting and writing is that whatever happens to you, you can eventually use it in some way. There's something you can learn from it and either write about or put in a performance. Were you able to feel that way even when you were kind of down? That, like, eventually I can use this.
Yeah, the trick is to be able to get in touch with it, which takes a while because after all the years of abusing your body and your mind, you tend to burn out. So you don't remember a lot of feelings. You don't know how to get in touch with your feelings and what's happening inside yourself. But as long as you stay clean for a length of time, it will come back, and then you'll be able to use it. But the most important thing that happened in my work from not using drugs or drinking anymore was that I'm able these days to remain honest as an actor. Whatever emotions come up, I'm able to put them in my eyes, in my face, and in my heart immediately. And that's honest work. And that's what you see I think that's what you saw when you saw Sonny.
Since your performances as Sonny in Wise Guy, have you been getting a lot of new kinds of offers based on the performance in that series?
Yeah, I've been getting, I've been getting a lot of offers, you know, but what makes me happy is that I've been getting a lot of offers from people who literally, you know, they had like pools going around as to what month I'd die in, and they gave up on me, and now they've come back and they really are happy, and it's an inspiration, and that means more to me than the scripts and the offers and all of that.
Ray Sharkey co-stars with Gary Busey in the film Act of Piracy, due out next summer.
Good love! All I need is love.
You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
How are you covering Martin Luther King Day?
Well, today we go to Chicago to see how some very different people and some very different groups are celebrating the holiday and trying to make it especially relevant to them. In Arizona, something of a twist to the day's events, a march to demand that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday be celebrated as a state holiday. You may remember that Governor Evan Meekum decided against celebrating the day officially, and that's one of several things that has gotten him in trouble recently with his with the voters there. Also, the secrets of the King time capsule.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of a new television production of Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude. It's being presented as a three-part miniseries this week to kick off the seventh season of public television's American Playhouse. David says some of his favorite programs of the 80s have come from this anthology, but Strange Interlude isn't one of them.
Remember that scene in Annie Hall when Woody Allen and Diane Keaton are standing on her balcony? They're making small talk while their true thoughts are revealed to the audience. Long before Woody Allen used that technique for comedy, Eugene O'Neill used it for drama, in a marathon 4.5-hour play appropriately titled Strange Interlude. O'Neill doesn't just let a few characters speak their mind, he lets them all do it, and sometimes at the same time. It's a rhythm that takes getting used to, like talking on an overseas phone call, or watching Gorbachev be interviewed than waiting for the translation. Director Herbert Wise, who did I, Claudius, stages the play very simply for TV. He doesn't even use different camera angles to differentiate between speech and thought. Lines that are dialogue, the actors speak loudly. Lines that are thoughts, they whisper. Got it? Good, because here comes a sample. Glenda Jackson plays Nina. She's married a man named Sam, gotten pregnant, learned that insanity runs in his family, and aborted the unborn child. In this scene, she confides all this to her family doctor, played by David Dukes, who's secretly in love with her.
I promised his mother I'd make him happy. He's unhappy now because he thinks he can't give me a child, and I'm unhappy because I've lost my child, so I must have another baby somehow. Don't you think, Doctor, to make us both happy?
That look in her eyes, what does she want me to think?
That look in his eyes, what does he mean?
That's the way this play goes, for 4.5 hours, covering a generation in these people's very verbose lives. By the time Strange Interlude reaches its climax, the child Nina eventually has is old enough to be engaged, which leads to lots of friction from lots of different directions. Here's Jackson as Nina again, this time as a much older woman. She tosses off an insult at her son's fiancé, who responds in thought, followed by the thoughts of Nina's husband, Sam.
I am quite aware that my son is no weakling, although he does do weak things sometimes.
Ouch, that was meant for me. Why does she dislike me so? I've done my best for Gordon's sake to be nice to her.
Another nasty crack at Madeline. Nina's certainly become the prize bum sport. I thought once a change of life was over, she'd be ashamed of her crazy jealousy. Instead of that, it's got worse. I'm not going to let her come between Gordon and Madeline. He loves her and she loves him, and her family's got money.
That was Ken Howard, who used to star in The White Shadow, as Sam. And it's a piece of miscasting that Howard just can't overcome. Sam is a wimp, more of a puppy than a man. And Howard, who towers over everyone else and has a deep, strong voice, is about as wimpy as Arnold Schwarzenegger. Even more disappointing, though, is Glenda Jackson in the starring role. And that's a shock, because she got raves for performing the same role on Broadway a few years ago. This time, it's definitely TV that makes the difference. On stage, costumes and body language can do a lot. On TV, it's the close-ups that count. And as gifted an actress as Glenda Jackson is, it's virtually impossible to accept her as a fragile 21-year-old. That's a nice way of putting it, David, but why don't you say what you're thinking? Tell the truth, that when Glenda Jackson wears a pageboy wig and no makeup in the early scenes, she looks like Prince Valiant. Jackson is much more effective in the show's final acts. The cast members who age most gracefully and credibly are David Dukes and Edward Petherbridge, who almost make Strange Interlude worth watching. Oh, come on, David. Almost worth watching? That almost makes sense. Just tell people to skip it and stop talking to yourself.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, an interview and performance with avant-garde musician and composer Guy Klusevic. He's no longer ashamed to say he plays accordion. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile Television, a band that helped launch the New York punk scene in the 1970s. And book critic John Leonard will review Mothers of Invention, which chronicles the unrecognized role of women in the technological breakthroughs of the modern era. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myros, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Kathy Anderson and Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.